From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2014 when the New York Philharmonic Orchestra welcomed its first black principal player, clarinetist Anthony McGill. For the previous 5 years, the New York Philharmonic did not have a single black player. And think about that. A Philharmonic in one of the most diverse places in our country, not having any African-American representation. There's a lot of talk about diversifying classical music, but orchestras remain only about 4% African-American and Latino. And the audiences remain largely devoid of black and Latino representation, too. According to WQXR in 2015, 5% of orchestra audiences are African-American and Latino. 2 years ago, fewer than 1% of artistic directors were black. Fewer than 1% of orchestra CEOs were black. And that isn't that the story of corporate America, by the way? Poor representation of diversity at the lower levels of companies and almost nothing at all at the top. What if there were more diversity on stage and on boards and in the CEO positions? WQXR says that would almost certainly lead to more diversity in audiences. And that brings us to the 23rd Gateways Music Festival. It's a classical music celebration held biennially in Rochester, featuring musicians of African descent from throughout the United States, along with works by African-American composers. It runs August 8th through the 13th, so you've got some time to plan, and it's going to be at a variety of venues this year, including the Hochstein School of Music and Dance, Rochester City Hall, Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater, Eastman School of Music Performance Halls, houses of worship, even private homes. So we've got a lot to talk about this hour, and let me go ahead and welcome our guests, including Lee Kuntz, the president and artistic director of the Gateways Music Festival, who said August doesn't feel that far away, yes?
Seems like tomorrow.
Yeah, yes, you still have some time. Nice to have you here. Thank you for being here, Lee. Also here is Delaney Harris, who is a double bassist and a sophomore at the Eastman School of Music. Delaney, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Paul Burgett is here, chairman of the board of the Gateways Music Festival and University of Rochester vice president and senior advisor to the president of the University of Rochester. Also the teacher of some of the coolest classes, including what? What's the top of the list of cool that you teach?
Well, probably my history of jazz class, I think, but also, Musical Adventures, A Trip Too Hip to Miss.
A Trip Too Hip to Miss.
That's right.
You are the professor I wish I had. And Jamal Rossi is the Joan and Martin Messinger Dean of the Eastman School of Music. He says the dean of the greatest school on earth. Still feel that way?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. Good to see you.
Great to have you. Thank you for being back here. So, Leah, let me just kind of back it up real quick here. We're going to talk about a lot of different themes this hour, but when it comes to Gateways itself, I mentioned it's a biennial music celebration. It's coming up in August. What's some of the history for those who haven't been a part of Gateways?
Sure. Gateways has been around for about 24 years. I think this is our 24th anniversary. And it was founded by Arminta Hummings Dumasani, who's a Juilliard-trained classical pianist in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, came to Rochester in 1995 and has been supported by the Eastman School ever since. The festival has grown kind of exponentially and astronomically over the last 4 or 5 years. And we present 6 days of concerts, 3 chamber music concerts, 1 piano concert, and music throughout the community of Rochester.
And you've got August 8th through the 13th lined up at a variety of venues. And, you know, I mentioned sort of off the top this effort to diversify. It sounds like Gateways is at a wide range of venues that will at least try to give people different chances to see it in different settings, yes?
Right, it will. And Gateways, all of our performances are free and open to the public. So we've removed that barrier, right? And so we're all over the city. We're at Mount Olivet Baptist Church. We're at the Hochstein School of Music. We're at the Cornhill Landing. We're at the Central Library. We're all over Rochester. Houses of worship, as you mentioned, community centers. So we'll be everywhere for 6 days.
And a great chance as we kind of get ready for, everyone's kind of got a hop on their step. The warm weather is here. We're thinking about festivals. You're planning your summer. August 8th through the 13th. And if you want to take a look at what they've got, are you online? Easy to find.
We are. You can find us at www.gatewaysmusicfestival.org.
When it comes to this effort to diversify, you know, yes, there's a lot of talk. Lee, is there enough materializing that we see here? Am I missing the story or should we be concerned?
It probably is the biggest story right now in the U.S. In classical music. Orchestras have really taken this this subject matter on in a real substantive way that I haven't seen in the past. So the League of American Orchestras is one of the leaders in this initiative. And so orchestras around the country are really beginning to deal with this issue. And I think what a lot of them are finding, what is what we all know, is that the pipeline has to be fed a bit more strongly. So more folks of African and Latino descent need to begin learning to play musical instruments so that in the, at the other end of the pipeline, that professional end of the pipeline, there are more musicians out there.
You know, let me read a little bit of a piece the Huffington Post had on the lack of diversity on stages. And I'll start with you, Lee, and we'll ask all of our guests what they think here. This is from the Huffington Post. A couple of years ago, quote, black men and women have built practically every musical tradition in the West, jazz, blues, rock and roll, funk. But when it comes to classical music, both on stage and in the crowd, they're few and far between. Take Roy Eaton. Eaton grew up in Sugar Hill, New York in the 1930s, a once black neighborhood famous for producing a dizzying number of artists, musicians, and actors. Here's what Eaton had to say about the issue facing young black musicians today. Quote, most African-American homes do not, as a habit, listen to classical music. They haven't been shown the possibility, and also they don't see role models. This is something that has infuriated me. I was going to say irked, but it's not irked. It's infuriated me. Julius Watkins was one of the greatest French horn players I have ever met in my entire life, but he was black, so he couldn't get a hearing at the New York Philharmonic, end quote. That's what Roy Eaton had to say. Hmm. Lee, how do you feel about that?
I think Roy, by the way, is a former Gateways participant, and so we're hoping that he'll even join us this year. I think there's a lot of truth in what Roy says. People of African descent were overtly excluded from orchestras in this country, and he is right. There was a time when this music that we call classical music was really a vibrant part of the black community. The one thing I'd like to add, though, is that people of African descent have been involved in this music, this thing we call classical music, since the 16th century or before. So there's a black trumpet player in the courts of Henry VII and Henry VIII. Beethoven wrote the Kreutzer Sonata for George Bridgetower, a man of African descent. So folks of African descent throughout history have been involved in this music, and Roy is right. In our communities, there was certainly much more classical music in the church, in fraternities, sororities, the historic HBCUs, the historic black colleges and universities, and we've lost a lot of that. And I think what's important about Gateways is that we're showing that this tradition can once again become alive in the black community. And the more kids in particular who see Gateways musicians, they can say, you know, I want to be that. I want to do that. So the important part of what Gateways is about is becoming more visible.
Modeling, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly what Roy's talking about. Paul Burgett, what do you think?
I concur with everything that Lee has just said. It's interesting. Being able to see classical musicians of African descent by young people is so important. As I was listening to Lee, I was reminded that last week I had lunch with Roland Williams. Now, Roland Williams is a retired NFL superstar. He was on the St. Louis Rams, as a tight end for the St. Louis Rams, and that won the Super Bowl in 99, I think it was. But at any rate, he's a Rochesterian who lives in L.A. now. But he comes to Rochester, and he's developed something called the Champions Academy, which he has 325 children from middle school and high school kids from Rochester, from the city. And he's building all sorts of programs to be supportive of them. And so he and I were talking about Gateways. And I said to him, Roland, here's an opportunity for you to bring 325 children at no cost to you to Kodak Hall at the Eastman Theater to look at a stage that will be filled with classical musicians of African descent, something that most Americans have never seen, and these children certainly have never seen, and it will be an astonishing experience for them. And so that's part of the audience we're expecting for our final concert on August the 13th. So building these images for our young people especially. Lee made the comment about the pipeline, and Jamal can talk about pipeline as well, because the Eastman School is very much concerned and involved about creating the pipeline. Creating that pipeline is an important part of what Gateways is all about, and I think in doing that, we can hope to see more young people taking lessons, getting involved in instruction, playing, and thinking of themselves as musicians, as lovers of music, and perhaps even as professional musicians.
Jamal, you want to add to that on the pipeline? Go ahead.
Would love to. I want to actually start by going back to that quote that you read. And if you turn the clock back 50 or 60 years and looked at symphony orchestras, they were nearly 100% white males. That's not the case today. Today, females are generally 50% or sometimes more. Asian or Asian Americans make up a large percentage, but we've made no progress really with other underrepresented minorities. And the question has to be asked, why? And I believe it is access and opportunity. Yep. The solution to this is children. You have to provide access and opportunity for children, not only to make music, but to study music with really supreme teachers. And so at Eastman, we've looked at, well, first of all, let me say one other thing, and that is in academia, we have the same exact problem that symphony orchestras do. Mm-hmm. You know, Rochester Philharmonic has one African-American trumpet player. We have one African-American violist on our faculty. To change that, you can either try to recruit somebody from another symphony or school, but that does nothing to increase the pool, or you have to start with children. And our goal is to find a way to provide every child the opportunity to experience the joy of making music. A couple of years ago, six partners in Rochester got together to say, what can we do about this? So Eastman, our community music school, the Hochstein School of Music and Dance, the City of Rochester and the City School District got together to say, how do we provide greater access to these students and opportunity? And we created Rock Music. Rock Music is an after-school music program that takes place 3 days a week. It's completely tuition-free. Students show up, they get a snack, they get 2 hours of music instruction, they can have dinner afterwards. It is a place where they are getting instruction from really outstanding teachers. Over 4 years now, the attrition rate is very, very low. Mm. 15 of these students are now at the School of the Arts. To me, the critical element of that is if you look at the city school district, it has a 42% graduation rate, sometimes as high as 44 or 45%. The School of the Arts has an 88% graduation rate. These students now, their chance of graduating from high school has doubled. Their chance in life, I think, is so supremely brighter. Not all of these students will go into music, but some will. Some will get that bitten by the music bug and feel like, this is what I have to do with my life. They have an opportunity to attend the Eastman Community Music School or Hochstein tuition-free. They have a chance to come to the Eastman School of Music as students. And we are trying to build a strong mentoring program, really with our partnership with Gateways, to support these students all the way through until they are successful young professionals. So while I'm excited about that project, we have the capacity of serving 100, maybe 200 students. A dream would be 300. It's a 30,000 student school district. We have to find a way to get music in the hands of every child. Then, if 1 or 2% want to go into music, we'll actually have some serious numbers.
I want to turn to Delaney Harris, who's a double bassist and sophomore at the Eastman School of Music, with a caveat. To be fair to Delaney and everyone here today, I am drawn back to an article I read recently by Gene Demby, who works for NPR and wrote about the experience as a black journalist covering Ferguson. And he said he often talked to Jamel Bowie and Wesley Lowery and a number of African-American journalists about how underrepresented journalists are. And when it comes to, I mean, newsrooms are pretty white. And often a black journalist is the only black journalist on a staff. And Denby wrote about the pressure African-Americans can feel to say, oh, well, you know, our well-intended white colleagues come to you and say, oh, well, tell us what all black people think. You know, one African-American is supposed to speak for. And so what I want to do is talk to Delaney about her experience, not because it's representative of an entire population, but I think it still is instructive to help understand, you know, how our experience brings us into music, into different pursuits, and why sometimes those doors open and close. So I hope that caveat is fair. And so, Delaney, it's great having you here. And obviously you're here because they have a lot of confidence in your double bassist. What else do you play? What are the instruments you play?
Well, I started off with piano. I stopped for a while, but now I came back to it since I'm at Eastman. And I also taught myself how to play the flute and the bassoon in high school.
Nice. Why did you stop piano, by the way?
I didn't like it.
See, this is its own show. I want to do a show because I've got a 5-year-old and I would like him to learn piano. I wish I had learned piano. I wish I had stayed with piano.
Yeah, same.
And how many adults look back and be like, why did I quit piano? You know, that's the age-old question. How are we going to fix this and make it cooler, attractive to kids? But that's its own separate show. But Delaney, you grew up, you said, in L.A.? You're from L.A.?
Yes.
Okay. Was classical music on at home when you were growing up?
No, but I do have a pretty musical family. To a certain extent, it was. My sister did sing in choirs, and mm-hmm. she went to Interlochen and stuff growing up. She ended up not wanting to go into that, but my family is really into music. I'm the only person that decided to go into music, but music was introduced to me as sort of just to see if I would like it. It was I was probably about 6 or 7 when I started going into music, and my mom didn't really know that I was going to take to it as much as I did. So it wasn't a serious, you know, thing at first.
What do you remember about your first memories about, you know, sort of encountering classical and composed music?
What I do remember playing my first real music was before high school. I went to my first music camp. And that is when I decided that I really wanted to get serious about it. So when I started playing real music and real symphonies and having my first experiences doing that, that's what really made me realize that that's what I wanted to do.
Why are you using the term real music, by the way?
Well, because when I started playing, the programs that I was in weren't really designed to create musicians. They were sort of designed to occupy kids and make sure that they stayed out of trouble, really. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of just playing, you know, small arrangements and you know, huge class sizes, and people weren't getting the one-on-one, you know, attention that they needed. And I was lucky enough to play an instrument that apparently not that many people wanted to play, and a lot of people just kept quitting playing the bass, so our class sizes got smaller and smaller. Hmm. And then I was able to get some one-on-one time with my teacher, and he really took an interest in me, and that's when I started getting into having better experiences.
Why did you like bass?
You know, bass was actually an accident. I didn't choose to play it. I was in a program that you would learn about all the instruments, and then you would list your top three, and they would try to honor your, you know, what you wanted to play. But if they needed something, then they would put you on something. And bass was actually not even in my top three because I didn't know much about it. It seemed, looking back on it, I don't think they taught us much about the bass. And it was funny because right before going into my meeting to see what I was going to play, my mom was like, "Delaney, what about the bass?" And I was just like, I don't know much about the bass. And then we went in there and they were like, "Delaney, we want you to play the bass." And then I was just like, okay. And I don't know, I ended up really loving it because I had a teacher that really supported me and really believed in me and took an interest in me. And that was, and I honestly, I would not be a musician if it weren't for that teacher. So that's really what inspired me to be a bass player.
Delaney, as a woman of color in this world, are you aware of the lack of diversity? Does that enter your mind often, ever? You know, tell me about that.
Well, one of the things about lack of diversity that really that I really realized after coming to Eastman was what we were just talking about, the pipeline and opportunity and things. Because Eastman is obviously just such a great school, and looking back to where I'm from, the neighborhood that I live in is some 97-98% black, and to think that the people in my neighborhood and where I'm from literally have no idea places like Eastman exist. And I find that baffling because this is such a great opportunity, and that's one of the huge issues. The diversity comes from people not even knowing that this is an option for them. It's actually beyond their scope of the world. And that's what's really it's crazy to me because I love Eastman so much, and I'm really glad that I'm able to attend Eastman, and I want that for other people. But if people end up not going to places like this, I want it to be because they decided that that's not for them, not because they never had a shot.
Yeah. I think that's beautifully said. What about your friends, those you grew up with, who sort of watch you, you know, go down this path, picking up these fascinating instruments? I mean, what were they saying?
Well, actually, my best friend is a tuba player.
All right.
yeah. So
great duets.
So we talk about classical music a lot, and she ended up not going into music. But so I do have some friends that, you know, play classical music, and I also went to an arts high school. But some of the people that I grew up with in my neighborhood are just like, they're totally like, it just goes right over their head. They're like, I don't know what that is or what you're doing or why you like it, because we don't understand it. And
And Delaney, Lee mentioned, and I think, and Paul talked about just this great opportunity coming up in August with Gateways, to have these audiences seeing models on stage, people who look like them. You know, when we talk about lack of diversity in teaching, we talk about how especially African-American students in the Rochester region, city and suburbs and rural areas, rarely see teachers who look like them. Students tell us, you know, who's going to inspire me? Not that teachers of different racial backgrounds can't inspire, but we know, the research tells us, that when you don't have models who look like you, you're less likely to feel like you've got an inspiring role model. How were you able to, I mean, did you grapple with that at all as you learned to play music? Did you say, hey, where are the African-American composers? How come they're not getting the same kind of love? Or what's the story here?
Well, I did a lot of different programs when I was in middle school and high school, and two of the programs that I was in were actually catered to minority students. So I actually did, there were some of the initiatives that were being taken, like the LA Phil has the Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, which is primarily Latino students. That's where I started playing bass and went throughout the program, and also the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, which is almost all Black. An orchestra that I love being involved with and really is doing great work to diversify this field. But when I would go places outside of those two places, yeah, I would be, you know, the only Black person, the only person of color there. And sometimes it can be discouraging, but I think about the greater good in that if I don't do it, then the people behind me, you know, the people who are younger than me, I can be that role model for them. So I think that that's, it's very important that I, you know, keep at it.
Delaney, that's just such beautiful ideas from her. I'm just so impressed. And Paul Burgett, just listening to Delaney, I'm hearing that what Jamil's talking about, what Lee's talking about, what you're talking about, it works if you can get people to see it. I mean, what Delaney is saying is, in her own neighborhood, there are people she grew up with who classical is not even on the radar. It's not, Eastman School doesn't even exist. These kind of things are not even, the instruments she plays, they don't even exist. But once they're on the radar, once they are real and tangible, then all of a sudden, you know, maybe we can do this. I mean, it sounds like it can work.
It can work. And one of the things that that I think Gateways is about is not only what we do in Rochester, but we have ambition to expand our wings more broadly over time. We have a strategic planning process that is currently underway, in which we're envisioning Gateways off into the future, 20 years into the future even, so that we can begin to create over time, a greater presence, a greater sense of the participation by people of color in this wonderful music. You know, as I look at the four of us around the table, Lee and Jamil and Delaney and me, our experiences in some ways are very similar. In that the exposure that we had, and so ensuring that we provide opportunities for that exposure for a broader number of people is particularly people in our particular case, students of African descent is very, very important. We see one of the things that I'd like to mention is for me an almost shocking realization when the Gateways musicians come together. When the Gateways musicians come, and they come from all over the country, this year for Gateways 2017. When the call went out for people these are professional musicians, to apply to participate in Gateways. Lee, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we had 226 apply. We have space for only 113. We could only take 50% of those. you should hear the musicians talk about the splendid experience of being together. And I'm talking about splendid experience of being together, making music at a very high level, at a professional level. In fact, during this festival, there will be, and Lee can talk about this better than I, there will be actually a forum in which musicians, Gateway's musicians, are going to talk about what this experience means to them. There's a sense, a tremendous sense of joy of coming together, of being together. The joy is first and foremost in making the music. I think for all four of us, I remember my first symphony. The first symphony I played was the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony. I was a 16-year-old junior in high school. And at the concert, I'm from St. Louis with the St. Louis Philharmonic. And at that concert, I remember tears streaming down my cheeks because it was so beautiful. And I think all of us will agree that the beauty of the music, first and foremost, is like a magnet. It just draws us in. But then when you see other people like yourself who are making that music, there's a sense of joy and satisfaction and completeness that we otherwise wouldn't experience. And so Gateways is critical, I think, to bringing musicians, in this case classical musicians of African descent, together to experience that joy. And I think that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. I'm mindful that, you know, in the Great Depression, the recording industry almost went out of business, as did many other businesses. And interestingly enough, one of the initiatives that helped to save the recording industry were what were called race records, records that were produced of blues and jazz, which were created for the black community, but were immensely popular by the American buying public, and helped save the recording industry. And in my wildest dreams, I think about what Gateways is all about and think that, you know, the effort of Gateways and other initiatives may go a long way towards helping preserve the traditions, the beauty of classical music.
Can music still get you to tear up, Paul?
Yeah, it does.
It still get you?
It does.
Well, we're having a conversation this hour about not only the Gateways Music Festival, which is coming up, but also these broader themes that I think Gateways is all about. And I want to get our only break, and we're going to come back, and we'll talk more about the specific Gateway schedule, and we'll talk to Lee Kuntz, who is the president and artistic director, about what we can expect coming up and what he's excited about, maybe what he's nervous about, what's still coming together. They got a little time. And I want to ask our panel as well, when we think about musicians, we think about composers of African descent who have been underrepped and maybe undercovered. What are some names? What should we seek out ourselves? You know, what's out there? So let's get our only break of the hour and come right back and continue the conversation on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, one of our favorite guests in the first hour, astrophysicist Adam Frank joins us. He attended the March for Science. We're going to talk about the very latest when it comes to understanding climate science and the challenges scientists are having. In our second hour, the Greater Rochester Initiative for Children's Social and Emotional Health. What's working and why? We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our colleague from Classical 91.5, Brenda Tremblay, sends a note, says, Evan, I remember seeing the first Gateways Orchestra at the Eastman School with William Warfield narrating Aaron Copland's Lincoln portrait. I cried. It remains one of the most visually impactful and beautiful things I have ever seen. Bravo to the Eastman School and the U of R and all of your guests. That comes from Brenda. Thank you, Brenda. We'll get to your phone calls in a second here, but let me turn to first of all, Dean Rossi. I mean, how was that student representation?
I have to say, Delaney, I'm deeply moved by what you had to say. And what I thought was really interesting was the fact that you said, you know, music or classical music wasn't a rich part of your family tradition. That's not unusual for so many of our students. Not all of our students come from families where their parents play classical music. Again, it's the exposure that they had as children through public school, through community music programs, through youth orchestras, that suddenly they have an opportunity. And I would just say that, I think about a local parent who a few years ago talked to me about her son, and she said, you know, my son now has opportunities I didn't even know existed because he's now part of a program. So those things are so important, and, you know, I'm so glad you're part of the Eastman community.
And Jamil, you know, when you think about that exposure. Are you concerned that the exposure is one thing, the opportunity to pick up an instrument for the first time, the opportunity to hear that kind of rich sound for the first time, but if there's not reinforcement at home, are you concerned they lose it? Or do you think, look, not everybody absorbs everything, but just that exposure can change lives, even if it's not 100%, even if it's not 50%, it can change lives?
My dream is that every child has the opportunity to make music. Not every child's going to love it, you know?
Yeah,
I had
right.
a chance to play soccer as a kid. I didn't love it.
Nobody's perfect.
But some kids will love it, and some kids will say, boy, I want to do this, and I want to get really good at it. Mm. And the key, I think, again, to this larger context of increasing diversity in music and classical music, it's not enough to play an instrument, and it's not enough to be an underrepresented minority. You have to be really good. Mm-hmm. So again, it is the opportunity to have inspiring teachers, like Delaney talked about, that really inspire a child to pursue something to a very high level.
All right, before I turn to Lee for more on what's coming up with Gateways, let me squeeze in a phone call or two. This is Trudy. Go ahead, Trudy.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I grew up in Germany, and we had to go. Germany is rich on composers, so is France, Italy, Russia, you name those countries. But we had to, during our music lessons, we had to go to classical concerts and operas. And, you know, that develops from childhood on into your growing into an adult. And the arts is very supported by the German government. And, for instance, we were in Leipzig. We went to the opera, and the music student who took our ticket said to us, after the performance, if you have to take a streetcar, you know, a train, you can go free on this ticket, you know, on your ticket from the opera. Now, I have seen, you know, we have been many times at the Metropolitan Opera. We have seen Placido Domingo, which I'm a great fan of. Then, talking about black opera singers, Jessie Norman, she started her career at the opera house in Berlin. What about Kathleen Battle? She's black. Both are black. Jessie Norman is a Wagner singer. So, you know, it's a shame, you know, that everything is private here. You know, over there, you know, you grow up with classical music. And how many opera singers are in Europe, in Austria, you know, they start their career there. So, you know, that's just what I have to say.
All right, Trudy, thank you for that phone call. Thoughts from our panel on that? Paul?
Government support of the arts in Europe, and particularly our caller mentions Germany, is a well-known fact to all of us around this table. And for me personally, would that we had greater support for art and culture in the United States. Trudy benefited enormously, and her peers have benefited enormously from what was supported by the German government. And I think those of us who are in the arts wish that were more the case here in the U.S.
And I think that extends even to school-age instruction. So government support of the arts, in particular music, in schools. And so even if those kids don't become professional musicians, that experience of playing a musical instrument makes them more likely to want to go to a concert or be on the staff of an orchestra, or be on the board of an orchestra, or be a donor. So the ecosystem requires more, as Jamal says, access and opportunity.
And you'll notice that Trudy made mention of the fact of the people that she identified were singers. Mm-hmm. And singers are born with their instruments built inside them. And the instrumentalist, which is what Gateways is about, and rock music is concerned with trying to provide students with instruments as well as the high level of instruction.
I would also say, you know, it sounded like Trudy as a child didn't have a lot of choice. You know, this was just part of what was in the culture. A dear friend of mine, Zvi Zeitlin, was on the faculty for 45 years, and he was a violinist. He once said, there's something to be said for not having choice. When his parents brought him to the United States to study violin at Juilliard as a child. And my point in that is, as over the last 15 years, we have moved toward a STEM education. And I understand why that has happened. but this extreme emphasis on science and technology and engineering and math has really left the arts and humanities on the sideline. Today, few students go to college for humanities because they didn't study it as children. The same thing with the arts. If they weren't required to have music as a child, if they didn't have the experience of playing an instrument, even if they don't stick with it, I think there's little likelihood that in 30 or 40 or 50 years they're coming back into the concert halls.
That's right.
So, you know, to me, it is about getting music valued in our society again and back in the school district, and not necessarily classical music, just music, and letting people experience music.
You know, the ascendancy of STEM, which is on the lips of just about everybody, science, technology, engineering, and math, there is a new term that I'll tell your listening audience that I loved when I heard it, and I would invite them all to consider adding it to their vocabulary, which is STEAM, science, technology, engineering, the arts, and math.
Let me get back to your phone calls. We're going to keep that in mind, Paul Burgett. STEAM. Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
I hate to throw a wrench in here, but I admire what the young lady is doing. I admire her calling, you know, as a professional. But we have to understand that music for African Americans has been a struggle, and it was not really accepted here in the United States as much as it was outside of the United States. And we've had great musicians who have traveled over the road singing and performing, had no place to sleep but their cars, and they used us as performers, but the music that we played, it helped them be joyful for a moment, but it didn't change their mind towards us as being human beings like they were, and they cared for our music but didn't care for us. And sure, some of this has changed over the years, and I hope it continues to change. I don't want it to sound all negative. There's been a lot of positive things that have happened, and music has opened up the doors for a lot of African Americans, and it's still opening up doors, but it's the acceptance of the music. I'll just name one, B.B. King, one of the great blues singers, but he was known more in England for his blues before he was known here in America for his blues. And it wasn't until late in his life that, you know, he became a great blues singer here in America. And I just wanted to say that, you know. Like I said, I don't want it to sound all negative and just say
you were
all
feeling good
things.
Until you called, Sam.
No,
but
Sam.
I'm kidding. No, he's making it. Stay there, Sam. Yeah, go ahead, Paul and Lee. Go ahead.
Sam, I want to thank you for this phone call because you are someone, I'm guessing, who has lived a life where you've been able to observe these realities. And we all need to be reminded of the policies and practices of exclusion that have kept African Americans out of certain areas where they have the country has benefited economically from what the African American community has had to offer, but full participation has been denied us. I can think of one very important musician who is a graduate of the Eastman School, Ron Carter, arguably one of the greatest jazz bassists in the United States, who moved into the world of jazz because the opportunities in the classical musical world, and he played with the Rochester Philharmonic when he was a student here, he recognized they just were not going to be, they were going to be denied him. So your observations, sir, are well taken, and you didn't throw a monkey wrench into anything. Mm-hmm. You're telling the truth, and I, for one, really appreciate it, and I think my colleagues do.
Lee?
Certainly, and I would say that everything Paul says is, I would echo that. And also to say that in the area of popular music, certainly there were issues with how black musicians were treated and how their music was taken advantage of. There were also issues, I think, on the classical side. So most orchestras in this country, from up until the 1960s, late 1960s, blatantly would not allow a player of African descent to play in their orchestra. right?
They wouldn't let them audition.
They wouldn't even let them audition. So the same issues that Sam is talking about in popular music, that also existed in the classical world. So there was very decided exclusion going on in the world of classical music up until very recently. And so those are some of the things that we're trying to battle.
And Sam, go ahead, Sam.
You know, Eartha Kitt was a great singer, but she was blackballed. Mm-hmm. And they did have a black director at the Eastman School of Music. And, you know, it was just, he was doing great things, you know, but they decided they needed to go in a different direction, I guess because the participation of students went down and, you know, and they didn't trust him with their future, so they had to bring someone else in, you know, that the kids would trust.
I actually think you may be referring to Isaiah Jackson, who I knew very well. And Isaiah left, and it was not with the Eastman School, it was with the Rochester Philharmonic. And Isaiah left, though, to go to England, where he had an opportunity as an opera conductor in England. And that happens with great talent. You know, you don't hang on to all of them, but he enjoyed a distinguished career here, but it was with the Rochester Philharmonic. And he left because there was a new opportunity for him.
You know, Sam, I also appreciate that you raised this point of the treatment of African-American musicians, and I only know that from what I have read, certainly not from experience. But I think back to when I was a young man in high school, and my heroes were all African-American. John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Cannonball Adderley, Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Ella, Billie Holiday. There is something about almost that that they are African-American did not matter. It was going back to what Paul said about his experience with the Tchaikovsky. It was the music that mattered. Mm-hmm. And it was made at the most, not just the highest level, but something that was so supremely touching. You know, that's mm-hmm. why I was so inspired to go into music.
And you should know, Sam, that Jamal Rossi is a saxophonist, so that's why he named off the people like Coltrane and Bird.
Can I ask our panel, and Sam, thank you for that phone call. That leads to sort of a question on auditions and screened auditions. Do screened auditions remove bias from a selection process? You know, and how do you develop a diverse audition pool in the first place? Because, you know, in preparation for this program, we're trying to read as far and wide as we can, and producer Megan Mack sent some notes on, you know, that while some auditions are truly blind, others first include screens, but then the screens are removed and there could be delayed bias. I mean, is there an ideal way to do this? I'll start with you, Jamal. What do you think?
I don't think there's a perfect way to do anything. But again, when you think about the transformation of symphony orchestras, especially by participation of women, I think that was due largely to adding screens and the fact that, you know, rugs were installed and mm-hmm. people didn't wear shoes, and so you did not know who you were listening to. And then at the end, you'd find out, oh, well, two of our three finalists are women. And, you know, I think that actually did a great deal to help diversify the orchestra. Mm. I think it's only good to a point because it depends on what one's goal is. If one's goal is to diversify, then at some point you want to know, do I have underrepresented minorities in this pool? Do I have women in this pool? Do I have other groups of individuals? Because do I want to somehow give them a special look? Because as an institution, we want to diversify. So let's seek folks out who, again, have an acceptable talent level that will help mm-hmm. our organization.
Lee?
And after a certain point, maybe you would agree with this, Jamal, the process is subjective once you get toward that level of playing. I mean, mm-hmm. they're all playing at an incredibly high level by the time you get to the finals. So, yeah, why not look at other criteria and bring in musicians based on the needs of the institution?
There is a kind of bizarre implicit bias associated with diversity. The very famous music critic for the New York Times for many years, Harold Schoenberg, actually wrote an article. He's the late Harold Schoenberg, but he wrote an article in which he argued vociferously that he could tell the difference between a woman playing the let's just say, the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, and a man playing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto with not seeing them at all, that he argued that he could tell that. Well, there's an implicit bias in all of that, and I'm not sure that Mr. Schoenberg had some God-given abilities that are denied most mere humans. But that implicit bias existed, and if the critic of the New York Times held it, I can imagine that others held it as well.
Hmm. Let me squeeze in one more quick phone call. Joel, and then I want to talk to Lee about what's coming up with Gateways. But go ahead, Joel, got to keep it tight.
So you've got a regional treasure there in Paul Briquette, and really appreciate that he's on. I've got a question. He's probably the most widely traveled person in Rochester. He's been to pretty much every country in the world twice, it seems. And I'm wondering if there's something he has to say about African-Americans and music and classical music globally.
And classical, did you say classical music globally, Joel?
Globally, yes.
Well, we know, for example, in the United Kingdom, there is an orchestra of African-American musicians. Lee, what is it? What's the name of it?
And it's African-American and other people of color. And it's called the Chiniki Foundation?
The Chiniki, that's it, yeah. So I think, yes. And I think in African countries, particularly sub-Saharan African countries and major metropolitan sub-Saharan African countries, that you will find symphony orchestras of varying degrees of sophistication and quality. So my answer, I guess, is yes. I don't know a whole lot more about it than what I'm just articulating now. I have heard some of these orchestras, and I think also in South America, we've seen some astonishing developments in South America with El Sistema in Venezuela, and Gustavo Dudamel, who is the conductor of the LA Phil. There have been developments in that part of the world for historically underrepresented minorities.
Hmm. All right, Lee, get us set for August 8th through the 13th. That's coming up, the 23rd Gateways Music Festival. And, you know, what stands out? We're going to start marking our calendars and making plans. Go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Evan. This may be the most exciting festival we've ever had. For one, I think it will be the most history covered in any festival we've ever had. So we're starting out the festival with the first symphony of Joseph Bologna, Le Chevalier de Saint-Georges, who is an 18th century composer during the time of Mozart and who conducted the most popular orchestra in Paris during the 18th century. So we're starting out with his first symphony, and we're going all the way to the 21st century and featuring a work by Jesse Montgomery, who it's not a premiere, but it's one of the early performances of her Records from a Vanishing City, which portrays her memories of her life growing up on the Lower East Side in New York City. So Records of a Vanishing City. So all the way from the 18th century to the 21st century and everything in between. We'll be also featuring the extraordinary Canadian pianist Stuart Goodyear, who's actually from Toronto. And I believe this will be his first performance in Rochester. I believe I'm correct on that. His first performance in Rochester. He is one of the phenomenal pianists of our day. And he'll be playing the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto. And we're ending our final concert with the Brahms Second Symphony, which is certainly one of the ones that makes all of us cry fall.
And makes the brass players happy.
It makes the brass players really happy. So that's the final orchestral concert. But then throughout the entire week, there's incredible chamber music. We've recently discovered, one of our participants this year recently discovered the kind of lost piano quintet of Florence Price, which none of us have heard. So we've only heard snippets of the final movement. So we can't wait to hear this piece. And we featured Florence Price's symphony last year, or in 2015 at the festival. So it's this broad range of music played by some of the most extraordinary musicians in the country who are players at major symphony orchestras, who are on the faculty of conservatories and music schools around the country, who are freelancers coming together to make music.
All right. And once again, online, you can check out the schedule and learn a lot more about Gateways. Where, Lee?
www.gatewaysmusicfestival.org.
gatewaysmusicfestival.org, August 8th through the 13th. A great opportunity. Everything's free?
Everything is free.
Everything is
that
free.
That said, we invite our listening audience, because everything is free, but our listening audience does indeed appreciate the fact that there's no such thing as a free lunch, that feel that they would like to support us.
Sure.
We welcome that support, and there are opportunities for people to help support us financially, and you simply go to the website www.gatewaysmusicfestival.org, and you can find ways to contribute financially to the festival.
All right, real quick, because we're down to like 20 seconds, but just some names here. We're going to write down names. We're going to look them up. We're going to listen to their Lee, composers, performers.
Chevalier de Saint-Georges. Certainly look him up.
He's referred to as Le Mozart Noir, the Black Mozart, because they lived at approximately the same time.
Mm. We're also performing Adolphus Hale Stork, an American port of call, and he was born here in Rochester.
Wow. All right. Just a couple of examples, and we could probably, end up just talking all day about this, which is what we learn every time we talk Gateways. And I just want to thank Lee Koontz, President and Artistic Director. Have a great festival. Thanks for being here, and really appreciate your insight here.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks to Jamil Rossi. Dean Rossi, thanks. Always wonderful having you.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Paul Burgett, somebody called you a regional institution, I think.
A regional treasure.
A regional treasure.
Use, so right. It a jewel.
Did you trademark
maybe
that?
Maybe a former student of mine.
Oh, great having you, Paul.
Yeah,
regional
you.
Treasure. And Delaney Harris, on her way to a wonderful career, a sophomore at the Eastman School of Music. Thank you so much for being here, Delaney.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden and Megan Mack behind the glass. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we're right back with you Wednesday on member-supported public radio.